President Raisi tells the Iraqi Prime Minister that Tehran is determined to expand ties with Baghdad. Mustafa al-Kadhimi hails Iran for its role in defeating Daesh terrorists. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says that talks with the visiting IAEA chief were constructive, and what matters is building mutual trust. The U.S. government releases the first batch of documents that support allegations about Saudi Arabia's role in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. It's good to have you with us. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says that his country is determined to expand relations with neighboring Iraq. He said that the two sides are able to further promote their ties in all spheres, despite outside interference. Raisi was speaking during a joint presser with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Tehran. The Iranian president said that the Iraqi side has agreed to a visa waiver regime between the two countries. The Iraqi Prime Minister also said that his country attaches great significance to ties with Iran. He also appreciated Iran for its role in defeating the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq. Al-Kadhimi arrived in Tehran earlier on Sunday on a one-day trip. From London, I'm now joined by Saeed Chahabi, a political analyst and Middle East expert. Good to have you with us, Mr. Chahabi. So, how do you look at the relations between Iran and Iraq, two neighboring countries, and how significant are these ties? And the two sides are determined to even further expand these relations.
Thank you very much. It is, of course, a significant move by Mr. Kadhimi to visit Iran, and this has come now after the events in Afghanistan. This shows that the Iranians have adopted a pragmatic, while at the same time principled policies by strengthening their relations with their neighbors at the expense of the American relations with these. So we know, everybody knows that the Americans went and brought down or helped and participated in a war that brought down the regime of Saddam Hussein, but then Iran was the main beneficiary. Now it had brought down it has changed its position in Afghanistan, and Taliban came to power. Again, Iran is making good progress in its relations with Afghanistan, with Taliban and others. So the pragmatic approach based on principles and values have proven to be more effective and useful than the use of force by America and its allies. Sheer force and the use of unproportionate or disproportionate force against others, it has just simply did not really achieve what America wanted.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments, Saeed Chahabi, political analyst and Middle East expert in London. Iran says it has had constructive talks with the visiting head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The new head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, made that announcement after meeting with Rafael Grossi in Tehran. Islami said that the talks were concentrating on technical issues, and there had been an agreement over the replacement of old memory cards of the agency's cameras at nuclear facilities. He noted that building trust has been of utmost importance for both sides. Grossi also called the meeting pretty important and positive. He said Iran and the agency should expand their cooperation. The one-day visit by the IAEA chief is his first since President Ebrahim Raisi assumed office in August, and the visit comes ahead of the Monday meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. A flotilla of the Iranian Navy has returned home after accomplishing its mission in the high seas. The vessels arrived in the southern port city of Bandar Abbas early on Sunday and were welcomed by military top brass. Present at the ceremony was Commander of the Iranian Army, Major General Abdurrahim Mousavi, who praised the crew members of the Iranian Armada for having completed their mission successfully. is that the Navy fleet carried out its mission in the worst climatic conditions and in the midst of the enemy's political campaigns and psychological warfare. The general said that a historic mission was accomplished thanks to the Navy's prudence, knowledge, and bravery, and under the guidelines of the Islamic Revolution's leader. The commander of the Iranian Navy has given some details regarding the mission of the naval flotilla.
During this mission, this destroyer experienced four seasons and it passed across the two hemispheres. It was important for us to, I mean, my comrades here, it was important for them to hone their skills, to, and they showed their capabilities and they demonstrated their skills. And what was important was that they didn't stop during the mission without any need for any logistics. They went all the way to their destinations and came back. And this shows that in the domain of naval missions, it is important that definitely equipment run into problems, technical problems, one way or another. But their capabilities were so high that we didn't need any assistance from any other ports in other countries. The U.S. does not have a proper understanding of Iran, and they do not know our capabilities. And they just read some reports and... Well, you see, anybody who is wise enough knows the capabilities of Iran. So anybody who is wise enough, he or she knows how things play out. So, and this mission was accomplished powerfully, and we will continue our presence with more might and power and with more lofty objectives.
The United States has declassified a batch of documents that has strengthened suspicions of Saudi officials' involvement in the 9/11 attacks. The hugely redacted documents detail logistical support a Saudi consular official and an intelligence agent provided to at least two al-Qaeda operatives involved in a hijacking of airliners used in the attacks. The FBI has also found the agent deeply involved in providing travel assistance, lodging, and financing to the hijackers. Members of the Saudi government have long been suspected of involvement in the attacks, but the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. has denied any role. The documents are released on President Joe Biden's executive order. He issued that order after more than 1,600 families affected by the attacks asked him not to attend the ceremonies marking the 20th anniversary unless he released the documents. Israel has performed fresh air raids on the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas south of the besieged Palestinian territory. Warplanes fired at least six missiles at the Rafah. The military claims that they targeted positions belonging to the Hamas resistance movement. Israel says that the airstrikes came in response to rockets and incendiary balloons from the coastal sliver. No casualties or material damage reported. Palestinians have gone on a strike in the occupied north and west bank city of Jenin in solidarity with escaped prisoners targeted by the Tel Aviv regime. The strike comes amid days of a massive manhunt in the area, where the regime forces conducted extensive raids and even arrested the family members of the escapees. Four of the six prisoners that broke out of maximum security Gilboa jail on Monday have been recaptured and taken to court. Two others still remain at large. Palestinian resistance groups have condemned the manhunt, saying that those developments signal a new round of explicit conflict with the occupying regime. Now moving on, China is saying it has administered more than 2 billion doses of the coronavirus vaccines across the country. The National Health Commission made the announcement on Sunday, and the country has registered 46 new daily infections, with 44 asymptomatic cases that China did not classify as confirmed. Currently, the total caseload there, the birthplace of the virus, stands at over 95,000. Chinese officials have repeatedly stressed they would provide jabs and technical support to other countries, despite domestic demands. President Xi Jinping recently announced his country would donate 100 million more doses of vaccines to developing countries. And this is part of a global fight against the pandemic. An anti-COVID Green Pass protest has been held in the Italian capital city, Rome. People who attended the event called on the government to withdraw a provision that further extends a COVID health scheme.
On Saturday, in the Italian capital, hundreds of people staged a protest against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass, which came into effect on August 6 and whose effects are set to be further extended. The Italian government is planning to make the so-called vaccine passport a requirement for employees at all public sector workplaces, as well as potentially at key businesses in the private sector, including supermarkets. At the rally, protesters were holding banners which read "United for Freedom of Choice" and "Hands off our children."
We are against all discriminations. People should be free to choose what's best for them, as stated in our constitution. Let me make clear that we are not against the vaccine.
Imposing a vaccine passport is nonsense. It's tantamount to blackmailing people. Furthermore, vaccines are still experimental and there are many unknowns about their effects.
The vaccine passport has been required since early August in order to access cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the health certification has become obligatory for long-distance trains, domestic air flights and schools amid widespread grumblings.
Free vax protests held across Italy over the past weeks have often turned nasty. A few days ago, the police staged raids in several Italian cities against anti-vax extremists, during which weapons such as knives and clubs were found.
Le azioni sicuramente ledono.
These episodes have certainly affected our campaign. Let me add, however, that the media have purposely emphasized isolated incidents with the sole aim to criminalize all forms of dissent. So far, after weeks of protests, 8 people only have been put in custody by the police.
Anti-COVID Green Pass protesters at Saturday's rally in Rome were joined by supporters of far-right party Forza Nuova. An anti-vaccine passport protest was also held in Milan, with about 5,000 people parading in the city center. Max Civili, Rome.
Now in Turkey, thousands of people have held a demonstration in Istanbul against COVID vaccinations and the government's related restrictions. Protesters said the new measures violate their rights and are against international law. On Monday, the government began requiring proof of vaccination or negative COVID tests for all users of inner-city planes, buses and trains, as well as for those attending large events such as concerts. All unvaccinated school employees are required to take a PCR test twice a week. Masks and social distancing are required in public places. Nearly 65% of the Turks have received 2 vaccine shots. Still around 23,000 new cases on average are reported on a daily basis. The U.S. president has issued a vaccine mandate which would apply to around two-thirds of all American employees. The decision has drawn criticism from senior Republicans who are threatening to sue the Democratic administration. Meanwhile, the fate of the U.S. economy is hanging in the balance.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
At least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating in a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Advising to follow the instructions of the National Committee on Combating Corona and not participating in the Arbaeen Walk, September 21st, 2020. Well, my discussion is over. I only wish to add something about the issue of the coronavirus. You should not underestimate the coronavirus. When 150 compatriots are lost every day, is this a minor issue? Some people do not have a correct estimate and evaluation about this issue. Imagine that an airplane with 300 passengers crashes every 2 days and all of them die. Is this a minor incident? If we have 140, 150, 170 victims every day, is this a minor tragedy? The cure is in our own hands. Well, as you see, the officials in charge are really sacrificing themselves. Physicians, nurses, managers, and others are all working hard. Therefore, we people should carry out our duties, keeping social distance, wearing a mask, and observing the instructions given, such as washing hands, are necessary tasks that should be carried out.
Anamazlum Hussein, Anamazlum. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
There is a debate about Arbaeen. Well, some people love Imam Hussein and Arbaeen. It is clear. All of us do. Well, many of you have gone on an Arbaeen pilgrimage, but I have been deprived of it, although I have been willing to go. Although we are away from you, we speak in your memory, from a poem by Hafiz. However, participating in the Arbaeen rally depends on the opinion of the officials in the National Anti-Corona Headquarters. If they say no, and so far they have said no, everyone should follow and obey. If we go to the border to express our love, this is not a good course of action. We can do so at home. There are 2-3 supplications for Arbaeen. On Arbaeen Day, all the people can read the Arbaeen Ziyara in an attentive manner and complain to Imam Hussein, greetings be upon him, saying, O Master of Martyrs, we wish to come, but it was not possible as things are like this. The Imam will pay attention to us and help us remove this obstacle.
On August 30th, 2021, just as the clock was about to strike midnight, the last U.S. forces departed from Kabul International Airport, finally bringing the war in Afghanistan, America's longest war, to an end. At least officially, anyway. Right on the cusp of the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, Joe Biden declared he would not pass on the war that he voted for onto a fifth president, declaring the U.S. counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan complete. But how exactly can Biden talk about a successful mission and a successful withdrawal when the U.S. and the Afghan forces had spent years training were all but chased out of the country? And during the evacuation, a suicide attack ripped through Kabul airport, killing 170 people. And in response, the U.S., of course, finished the war the same way it started the war, by massacring civilians in a deadly drone strike which left 10 Afghans dead. This is America's longest war, but only one part of the war on terror, or as it should be called, the war of terror. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. As the last C-17 cargo plane took off from Kabul's international airport on August 30th, international headlines and news outlets worldwide all declared the departure of the last remaining U.S. troops, with the rest of their NATO allies like the United Kingdom also leaving in the days just prior. Broadcast on virtually every news network, this iconic image in infrared, shot in the dead of night, showing the last soldier, Major General Chris Donahue of the 82nd Airborne Division, climbing up the ramp of a C-17 cargo plane. The last American soldier to leave Afghanistan after a war that lasted two decades and claimed the lives of so many. It's said that around 50,000 Afghan civilians died in this war, but that is just a conservative estimate. The real figure is likely in the hundreds of thousands, with millions more being turned into refugees. Last year, Afghanistan's economy ministry reported that 90% of Afghans live below the poverty line. Following the departure of the last U.S. troops, people were in the streets celebrating, firing their guns in the air. Just take a listen to BBC's Lise Doucet, who reported from Kabul.
Well, I don't think we need to look at the news wires. You just have to listen to what's happening in the skies above us in Kabul. If that isn't confirmation, I don't know what is. Just listen to the crackle of gunfire.
Taliban fighters then quickly took over Kabul's international airport, the main site of U.S. evacuation efforts, and could be seen sweeping the hangars, inspecting the various aircraft and equipment left behind by the American troops. The crackle of gunfire continued well into the night in celebration of the Americans' departure. Aware that they were leaving, people had desperately clung to those very same U.S. planes taking off just a week ago. And as Biden had declared the counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan a success, a horrific explosion, the result of a terrorist attack, ripped through the crowds of people waiting to be evacuated outside the airport, killing 170 people and leaving 200 wounded. In response, Biden issued a strongly worded message and had this to say to the attackers.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Except that's not what happened. The next day, the U.S. launched a drone strike against alleged members of Daesh that it said were responsible for the attack, which of course is always convenient, right? As soon as there's a terrorist attack, all the intelligence services in Britain and America suddenly know exactly who is responsible and where these terrorists live and where to find them, but never before the attacks, which coincidentally helped them advance their agendas. Now, the Pentagon announced that in this drone strike, it had killed two high-profile targets from Daesh and wounded another. The Pentagon also said there were no civilian casualties. That was a lie.
Yesterday, U.S. military forces conducted an over-the-horizon counterterrorism operation. Two high-profile ISIS targets were killed, and one was wounded. And we know of zero civilian casualties.
There were indeed many civilian casualties. When Biden launched that drone strike, something which he previously called an over-the-horizon capability, he murdered 10 civilians and then tried to cover it up just like every war criminal president before him. Among the dead were seven children and three adults of the Ahmadi family, the youngest victim being 2 years old. This horrific murder of civilians and basically an entire family is not some isolated incident or an accident. It is emblematic of America's war on terror, or as it should be called, the war of terror. Some people may think that this is just an anomaly or an exception. They think that civilians being killed is just collateral damage, an acceptable price of war. However, it's neither an anomaly nor acceptable. What do you think the war on terror has been for the last 20 years? The whole time, innocent civilians have been killed by NATO forces and their deaths covered up. Half the time, the U.S. is not even sure who it is killing and then covers up the deaths. Just to give you an example, before Chelsea Manning leaked evidence of war crimes to WikiLeaks, there were 15,000 deaths in Iraq that were previously unknown but were kept secret by the U.S. military. Daniel Hale, a whistleblower who is now in prison, leaked information about the U.S. drone program and showed that under Obama, during a five-month period, 90%, yes, 90% of all the people killed by U.S. drones were not even the intended targets. They were civilians. This was covered up and kept hidden in order to avoid embarrassing the United States and exposing its criminal behavior. For the last two decades, ever since George Bush began the war on terror by invading Afghanistan, an imperialist project that has been continued by every president since, we have been told, the world has been told, that America and its allies are fighting global terrorism. They claim that they are making the world safer. But if you just look at the data, you can see that this is simply not true. Ever since the start of America's war on terror in 2001, the number of suicide attacks increased, with more suicide attacks worldwide than ever before. And after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the number of global deaths from terrorism didn't decrease, it increased dramatically. The war on terror has made the world less safe and more violent. And such is the reality of America's war, not just in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and so on. And on the eve of the withdrawal, Biden gave a speech marking the end of the 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, America's longest war in history. Biden talked about the dead Marines that were killed in the attack at Kabul airport several times, but didn't even mention once the family that he murdered just a day before in a lethal drone strike. He didn't even mention the 170 Afghans who were also killed in the same blast. Why does American exceptionalism disregard the value and the lives of others? Biden started out by praising the withdrawal, praising himself, saying that 120,000 people had been successfully airlifted, among them 6,000 U.S. citizens. And Biden also said that he disagreed with critics who asked why the withdrawal couldn't have been done earlier or in a more orderly fashion. However, his response didn't address the fact that the U.S. abandoned Bagram Air Base last month, its largest air base in Afghanistan, in the middle of the night without even telling its allies or telling the Afghan security forces who were supposed to take over. And this begs the question, how can Biden call the withdrawal a success after creating such a security issue at Kabul's international airport? Why was the more capable, the more secure Bagram Air Base simply abandoned when it could have expedited things and perhaps helped to avoid such an atrocity? It simply doesn't make any sense. Biden then concluded his speech without taking any questions, but not before puffing his chest and making sure to issue menacing words towards Russia and China. He even dubbed them threats that the U.S. would have to contend with and reckon with at the same time as global terrorism. Now, CNN apparently did an interview with a Daesh commander just 2 weeks before this attack on Kabul airport. And of course, no opportunity was wasted by CNN's Clarissa Ward to make the issue about Sharia law and stoning people, trying, of course, to paint Muslims in a bad light, as Western media often does, instead of, you know, asking in-depth and pertinent, provocative questions about international relations, geopolitics, just given the seismic nature of this very war.
We were operating in Taliban's ranks, however, these people were not aligned with us in terms of belief, so we went to ISIS.
Do you think they're not strict enough with their implementation of Sharia?
You see, they can't present one example where they have enforced fixed Islamic law punishments, where they have cut off a thief's hand, have stoned to death an adulterer, have stoned to death a murderer.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The honor of being joined by Margaret Kimberly. She is the co-founder, editor, and senior columnist of the world-renowned Black Agenda Report, which has always been a cornerstone in the fight for Black liberation and at the forefront of anti-war and anti-imperialist journalism. Thanks so much for coming on, Margaret. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
Margaret, I want to ask you first, what are your thoughts on this latest horrific U.S. drone strike, killing 10 Afghan civilians, basically wiping out an entire family?
Well, it tells you the story of Afghanistan. This is what the U.S. has been doing for the past 20 years. All this, it's very funny this in this country how Afghanistan was kind of disappeared. You didn't hear about it very often, but this is what the U.S. was doing, killing civilians. But all the while, when they did talk about it, propaganda about keeping women safe and the Taliban were going to be so evil. But meanwhile, the drone strikes destroying. I remember when Obama was president and the U.S. killed people in a hospital. Excuse me. And so this is what the U.S. has done. So they decide to leave. I'm glad they're leaving. It is a good thing. But of course, they can't even manage to do so in a way that's efficient and humane. So they make a mess of their departure, having apparently planned very little, cause a bombing to take place as soon as Biden was taking criticism that magically there's a suicide bombing, and of course they vow revenge but kill a family with little kids. So Afghanistan, which was a huge scam, $2 trillion spent going straight to the military-industrial complex, propping up puppet governments with the phony army, and we saw how phony it was towards the end. And so that's how, so America leaves the way it entered.
In his speech, you know, Biden referred to China and Russia as competition and new threats. What do you think of that? What does it mean when, as Biden is ending the war in Afghanistan, he's calling Russia and China new threats?
Well, my only concern about the U.S. withdrawing from Afghanistan is that they plan to concentrate their efforts somewhere else. And Russia and China, especially China now, which adversary is the word they love to use. They're an adversary of the U.S. And that the U.S. has some right, just as it had the right to enter Afghanistan, has the right to confront China in its region of the world, because China has dared to be an economic rival of the U.S. So we hear constant propaganda, that is to say lies, about the Chinese government, about their people, about their infrastructure, everything, anything about China's, you know, China bad, you could just shorten it to that. So I am concerned about this withdrawal being part of a larger effort to confront other countries, and that is something we really have to keep an eye on.
You know, you see some people in the media who are visibly upset that the war is over. They'd like it to continue. I mean, what is your take on how the mainstream media is reporting on the issue and Biden's handling of it?
Well, everybody's performance has been abysmal. The corporate media in this country, they basically are mouthpieces for the state. They are mouthpieces for imperialism. And, you know, Americans even, it's a funny thing because I think if it were up to most people here, the U.S. would have left Afghanistan long ago. There was support for it in the wake of 9/11. That was the pretext for doing it. So there was very little opposition at the time. But there are many people, I'd say most people, who see no reason for the U.S. to be in Afghanistan after 20 years. So I think a withdrawal is something that, in the abstract, had popular support. But Americans like to think of their country as being good and efficient and doing things the right way. So I think there was, frankly, embarrassment. I think there was more concern about those first scenes we saw of people hanging on to airplanes. It was not the image that Americans have of themselves and have of their government. So it's easy for people who, in fact, may support the overall decision to be whipped up into a frenzy about America looking bad. These so-called journalists are just a disgrace. I mean, I thought he was going to cry, Richard Engel, you mentioned in particular, you know, this is not how America's supposed to be, and this is not how we are, and nothing, no mention, by the way, of the family that was wiped out in that last drone attack, nothing, apparently that is how America is supposed to be. It's really been terrible. It's once again, we see, if you want to know what's happening in the world, the last thing you should do is consume the information given by corporate media in this country.
And, you know, I know a lot of people say that the war in Afghanistan is about resources, and of course it is in part, but could you explain perhaps how this war, and in fact imperialism in general, is also linked to racism?
Well, there are many, it seems that the global south is always a target for plunder, for control, for propping up presidents. The president of Afghanistan left town with $170 million. But apparently he left some of it behind. He, you know, was stuffing his airplane so full of stuff, and some of it got left behind. But they have these leaders, quote unquote, who are trained by the U.S., go to U.S. universities, et cetera, and then go back to their countries to help the U.S. And NATO do whatever they want. And it usually is the global south. that is seen as being incapable of carrying on their own affairs and needing to be controlled. The white man's burden, still here we are in the 21st century. That's essentially what it is. But I tell everyone, who should run Afghanistan except Afghans? And I want to point out something else. It's, you know, this interference is 40 years old. It started when Carter was president. So this has been going on for a very long time. And the Taliban, who were, they were first the friends, they're the Mujahideen, and the U.S. was giving them money and weapons, and they met with Reagan, every president from Carter onward. This is a very long story, and people wringing their, liberals wringing their hands. Oh my God, the Taliban will run Afghanistan. Well, they're Afghans. They, you know, let people in Afghanistan figure it out, and it's not our business who runs that country. But it's not our business who runs any country, frankly.
What do you make of these people who are trying to, you know, use women's rights as a pretext to continue occupying a sovereign country, to stay in Afghanistan and keep the war going?
It's the last refuge of scoundrels. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't see any other way to look at it. Nobody talks about the Afghan women who were killed in drone strikes. Nobody seems to care about that. Nobody seems to, you know, there's amnesia about how, as I just said, these interventions have gotten rid of governments that would be friendlier to women and to their human rights. So that, to me, is very strange. But it just shows you how untrustworthy liberals are when you're talking about imperialism. This is a... no time for this reformist nonsense. This is a time to really be serious and to look at the impact that the United States has around the world, and to question all of it, to question the 800 military bases around the world, to question the defense budget. It's 60% of the discretionary budget in the United States. That's why we don't have the things that we need. So all of it, the right, this perceived right to intervene, the amount of money spent, the U.S. being all over the world, the biggest producer of fossil fuels in the world is the U.S. military. So people who claim to be concerned about climate change, they need to chime in here.
And when you have people in the media, or, you know, just pro-war people in general, imperialists, saying that the U.S. is abandoning its allies, what does that mean? What are they referring to exactly?
Well, it's leaving its puppets behind, but that's what they do. We're talking about people who are scoundrels. So, no, they don't care if the translators or whomever else helped them during their occupation get left behind. They don't care. They're used, they're chewed up, and then spit out. But because Americans believe in exceptionalism and believe their country is so good, and so even in their criticism, it's a kind of criticism that it's more about imagery, frankly. So we can't leave our friends behind. Well, you know, this idea of using the first person when talking about the country, we and us, when we talk about our government, I don't say we or us. I say them or they, but Americans can very easily fall into that we left our allies behind. Well, they are collaborators in the eyes of people there, and that's what happens in wars. That's what happens. But during 20 years, I'm sure there are thousands of Afghans who decided to survive by working with the Americans in some capacity.
Lastly, Margaret, you know, after Vietnam, which was also humiliating, people thought there wouldn't be another war like that. But then the war on terror happened, which is arguably even worse. So, you know, some people are saying the same thing now when they're talking about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Do you think the empire is, in fact, shrinking, as some say, or there's yet worse to come?
Well, there could be. I mean, considering these people who run our country, there could be something worse coming. You know, the system, the current defense secretary, Mr. Austin, came straight from Raytheon to the Pentagon. I mean, they're not even trying to hide it anymore. There's supposed to be some period of time. You can't go from a defense contractor to a position in the Defense Department. You're supposed to wait a couple of years. And they had this waiver. He went straight from Raytheon to the Pentagon. And that tells you all you need to know about how this all works.
As far as withdrawals go, what we've seen so far only deals with America's uniformed troops. However, if we look back at 2001, the first Americans on the ground in Afghanistan were CIA paramilitary. And earlier this year, in April of 2021, CIA Director William Burns said that the CIA would actually not be withdrawing, but in fact staying in Afghanistan, as we talked about previously here in the program. CIA Director Burns held a secret meeting recently with the Taliban, as did the head of Britain's MI6. It's also been reported in the media that members of Britain's Special Forces, the Special Air Service, or SAS, have even asked to remain in Afghanistan and potentially establish a covert base on the border with Pakistan. And this would, of course, require the approval of the Taliban, but it's been discussed under the pretext of fighting Daesh, and is something that still remains to be seen, but which does seem to indicate that operations won't come to a full halt, as many have suggested. So as the last U.S. troops and NATO troops depart from Afghanistan, there's definitely reason enough to exercise some caution. In the past, we've seen how George Bush declared mission accomplished barely 2 months after invading Iraq. In 2011, Obama said he was withdrawing from Iraq, and then in 2014, he was sending troops back in. And to this day, Iraq still has U.S. bases occupying it, like Ayn al-Assad and many others. And after Trump murdered Haj Qasem in January 2020, the Iraqi parliament last year voted to expel all foreign troops. This was ignored, and U.S. forces are still occupying the country. The United States has been at war with Syria for the last 10 years. Along with its NATO allies, they've been funding terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda in an attempt to overthrow the Syrian government. According to Syria's oil minister, around 90% of Syria's oil is under U.S. occupation. But if you ask the United States, they say they don't have any boots on the ground. So, I mean, if that's their idea of a counterterrorism mission in Iraq, or limited strikes in Syria, which they have no permission to carry out, or no boots on the ground, when they most certainly have boots on the ground, then what kind of withdrawal are we talking about from Afghanistan? After 9/11, when the U.S. Congress passed the authorization for the use of military force in 2001 to give George Bush permission at home to go and bomb Afghanistan, this AUMF never even specified that it was for Afghanistan or even for Al-Qaeda. It was always abstract on purpose, hence why it has been used since in order to bomb 19 countries. That AUMF is still in place, and if history has taught us anything, it won't be the last that we see of it. Afghanistan is just one part of the war on terror, or as it should rightfully be called, the war of terror. So just because the U.S. is supposedly leaving does not mean it's no longer an imperial power. Iraq is still under occupation. Syria is still under occupation. Palestine is still under occupation. The war on terror, waged at the behest of arms manufacturers and private contractors, is still in motion. The United States is not able to nation build. It is not able to impose democracy. It is not able to conduct counterterrorism missions. There is more terrorism today than there ever was before 2001. The United States and its allies have made the world less safe and more violent so they could make their empire bigger and their corporations richer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio. I'm Atal, the host of this program. This series of Viewpoints is concerned with the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Sadiq. Sheikh Sadiq, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum, very happy to be with you.
You're welcome, brother. And Sheikh Qasim, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, in a series of the programs of viewpoints regarding the speeches and the thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, today we want to talk about the important concept of safety, or it could be also roughly translated as security, and also calmness and tranquility inside, which these two terms or these two concepts are usually juxtaposed, come together. You know, one of the basic needs of human beings is finding peace and security. It could be on the individual level or the social level, and every person around the world wants to have a peaceful life, a life with calmness inside, a life which has no barrier, a life which has no distraction. But unfortunately, I myself believe that today's people in the world, especially in the 21st century, are very much distracted from the right path. And every day, this type of distractions and obstacles inside the human being, inside the spirit of the human being, are becoming more and more. So day by day, we are away from finding a kind of tranquility inside and peace inside. Sheikh Qasim, let's start with you, brother. So when we refer to the religion of Islam, what type of peace or what type of security are we exactly looking for?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وعلى بيت الطيبين الطاهرين. I think these two concepts or notions, I believe the centric one or the one that is placed in center is tranquility and peace, and security actually is one of the manifestations, one of the instances of the way a person feel tranquil or peaceful. So this is a very important point that we have to have in mind. The second point is that we can have two perspectives with respect to peacefulness. One of them is that it's sort of internal actually feeling.
That's right.
And the second one is that it's a sort of external one. What I mean by internal and external is that, for example, you may be in a situation or a society or in a very specific situation that whatever is going around you mm-hmm. is not a sort of secure or tranquil situation. For example, you take Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam in the day of Ashura as an example. That at that time, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was experiencing the most unsecure and untranquil situation. But at the same time, from within Imam Hussein alayhi salatu was salam, this is the report of those people around him that the more that the Imam alayhi salatu was salam would fight in that day, the more his face become bright and happy.
The more calmness you will find and tranquility. Yeah. Because the type of, I think, peace that they were looking for in nature was very much different from the type of the peaceful movements that we see nowadays in the world.
Yeah. So this is exactly what I said, that, the situation that is going on around you is not always actually defining the way that you are feeling and you are experiencing from your within about the world.
Yes.
So this helps us to define what tranquility really and truly is. And then we have to go to the fitra again, that this one thing that is within us with respect to having tranquility, where it's coming from, seek the place of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in our nature, that ruh, that spirit, divine spirit that has been blown into human beings, that is the source of tranquility that has to be there irrespective of whether the outside world, the external experience that you're having is a sort of tranquil or secure situation
or not.
That's
right. At least this pandemic, COVID-19 has shown that this type of peace or tranquility that is made around us is man-made. Okay, so a very tiny virus, in the world can remove it all. But what about the peace inside? Sheikh Sadeq, let's get to this very important aspect. Because, for sure we have role models in our life. The infallibles, the ma'sumin, okay? They had a kind of peace inside. That's why it's the most difficult situation. They could bear it all and bear all the consequences. But the case is that if you want to have this kind of security and peace inside, what should we do?
Let me try to paint a complete picture about safety and tranquility and happiness. So the goal is one goal. It's closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yes. And the problem is one problem. As we said, it's hubbu dunya.
Yes.
Hubbu dunya ra'su kulli khatir. Right? And we know from the verses of Quran that ala bi dhikri Allahi tatma'innul qulub. Remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings peace to the heart. And we know that Allah inna awliya illah la khawfun alayhim wa la hum yahzanun. We know that they're not sad, they don't have any problems, they're not afraid, they are secure.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, closeness to the big guy gives you security. Right?
Okay.
And being away from him, being close to dunya. And we also have this beautiful verse in the Surah Jum'ah. It says, قُلْ يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ هَادُوا إِنْ زَعَمْتُمْ أَنَّكُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ لِلَّهِ فَتَمَنَّوا الْمَوْتِ. So it gives us a sense of what it means to be awliyaullah, waliullah.
Mm-hmm.
If you think you are a friend of God, yearn for death. What does that mean?
No.
Does that mean friends of God yearn for death? They love death? Yes, because death is liqa'ullah. Going back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
And the opposite of death is attachment
to this world.
Attachment to dunya.
That's
right?
Right.
So on one side we have detachment from dunya, being awliyaullah, yearning for death, being friends with Allah and being friends with death, remembrance of Allah, and all of these are synonymous with peacefulness of the heart. And on the other side, on the other end of the spectrum, we have hubbu dunya, we have attachment to dunya, and it's source of all of these anxieties and depressions and problems. And why is that so? Because of the limitedness of dunya.
That's all right.
Dunya is limited, resources are limited, and
right.
Everyone is competing.
Yeah.
If you're against the world, everyone is going to take away your happiness for themselves to be happy.
And just look at the world today, man.
Yeah.
Just look at the people all around the world, how much they are taking medicines. These pills referring to the psychologists, following different type of therapy in order to find peace inside. And they do not find it. They do not find it, you know. And you know how much the rate of committing suicide is getting higher and higher in the world. The type of deaths the awliyaullah are looking for is very much different from the type of deaths these people are looking for, okay? That is in order to get back into the very nature of the divinity. Laqa Allah, as you said, closeness to Allah. But this one, I think is because of the obstacles on our ways. And day by day, it's getting harder and harder for the people to find peace inside. Religion, especially Islam in the true sense of the world, I think Shiite Islam can help us very much. At the same time, there are some... it's better to say systems of thoughts around the world call themselves mystical movements, that they are working in the same place. But there is a difference between these mystical movements and the religious beliefs, okay? They are giving people prescriptions too, how to find peace and to be secure inside. But if you find the peace and security inside in the true sense of the world, on that time, I think the whole world and the mechanism of the world is going to work properly. And there is no need for an